This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Hello and good afternoon. Great to have your company. I am Kate Forrester and I'll be with you for the next hour. Well, if you've done your weekly grocery shop recently, you might have noticed something in short supply. You know those small, sweet Carnarvon bananas that so many of us love and, you know, like to enjoy during these summer months? Well, they've been a little bit harder to find recently. So in the first half of the program, you're going to hear from a Gascoigne grower to why he is currently only harvesting half of his usual crop as we speak. That coming up before the news headlines, and obviously we'll check in with the weather to see what's happening across the state this afternoon and in the next few days. 6 past 12 here on the Country Hour. It's a pleasure to have your company for the next hour. Well, we can officially say tomorrow is the day when the world first social media ban for younger teens comes into effect across Australia. And for students living in rural and remote parts of the country, what it means is an abrupt switch off come tomorrow, just before we head into a long school holiday break. Sally Brindle is the Federal Vice President of the Isolated Children's Parents Association. Sally, how is the association feeling about the ban that comes into force tomorrow?
The association doesn't have a particular stance for or against this issue because we feel there are a lot of areas that affect people differently depending on where you live and how you live. You know, we want to keep our children safe from online harms, but that has to be weighed up against people and children being able to stay connected. And especially as this is something that a lot of these kids have grown up with, and now it's going to be taken away.
So what sort of discussions have you been having with other parents and members of the ICPA?
A lot of the discussions have focused around possibly a lack of consultation. Were there other alternatives that could have been looked at rather than prohibition? Could there have been more done around, you know, education on the usage of social media in a correct and proper manner? Then on the other side, there have been some conversations around maybe it'll help our children to be more connected on a face-to-face level.
How could this affect children who are going to be impacted by it if they're under 16?
So I think for a lot of our members, the timing is probably one issue that really could have been considered better. You know, the start of the school holiday for our families, especially those who have children away at boarding school, they have friends from all over Australia. Now their means of connection is being taken away from them at a time when they're going home to environments, when they're isolated from face-to-face connections with their friends, and now the means that they were using to connect is being taken away from them.
So when would be a good time to do this? Is there ever a good time?
I don't know if there ever is a good time. And like I said before, I just wonder, is prohibition really the right avenue to take? We don't want things to be driven underground. Children are very clever. Children are very tech savvy. You know, are there going to be emerging new platforms that the children can adopt to basically achieve the same thing that they're currently already doing? And how is the government going to keep on top of all those other platforms that come on board in terms of making sure that if they want to continue with this ban, that those platforms are held accountable as well? So I just feel that a prohibition is going to be very hard to police in terms of keeping up with how fast technology can move.
Because are you concerned it also might increase mental health challenges for kids?
Oh, look, for sure. I think that isolation is a real concern for those that are comfortable with using it and for those that currently have a pleasant experience with using social media. You know, some of these children are already isolated by geographical location and now they're going to have to learn how to deal with not being able to connect with their mates in the same way. So, you know, parents are going to have to be provide a lot of support to some of these children. Yeah, it's just going to be a very interesting space to watch.
Has the ICPA provided any coping mechanisms to parents in rural and regional areas across Australia to support them and their families through this rollout?
As an organisation, we haven't done that directly, but I do know that the Australian Boarding Schools Association have come out and spoken about the impacts that they foresee that may happen for isolated families. And I'm not sure whether they may have provided some resources to help parents cope in this situation. It's a new field, you know, it's a new area for parents to deal with, as well as the children. So it's a very difficult time. You know, it's a juxtaposition between keeping our children safe from online harms, but also not making them isolated or even more isolated than they already are.
And I guess maybe it's just a case of advising these children to go, I can't believe I'm saying this is old-fashioned, but going old-fashioned and getting their mobile number of their friends instead of relying on these apps.
Yeah, I think it might come back to the old adage of we have to know people's phone numbers, whereas I think a lot of children wouldn't even know what their mates' phone numbers are because they haven't had to use them because they have got these platforms. But it may encourage children to do more one-on-one conversations, but sharing things with a whole group of mates all at the same time is something that they're so used to that they're going to have to get used to something quite different.
What other realistic alternatives do you think rural families have to help their child's or children stay connected without social media over the summer holidays?
Well, for really remote and isolated children, it is very hard, but whether there are any of the platforms, I'm not sure if Messenger or WhatsApp platforms are going to be brought into the mix. That's another avenue, although it does work a little bit differently from your Instagram and your Snapchats. But I just hope that bringing in this prohibition, that it is actually reviewed, because I think if it's not going to be successful and it's not going to have the desired results, I do think it really needs to be assessed as to whether it is achieving what it set out to achieve.
And how soon would you hope to see that review?
Even the shorter time is a couple of months, I think they would be able to see what some of the impacts and effects are. And certainly for some of these rural and remote families, they'll be able to get feedback from parents about how it's affected their children over this holiday period to know, you know, what the impact is for those that are away from school. And the other thing to bear in mind is that also some parents actually use these platforms as a means of staying connected with their own children while they're away at school. So that's being taken away. So now those parents themselves are going to find different ways of staying connected with what's happening in with their children's lives when some of them, you know, are thousands of kilometres away from their family. As a parent myself, I've been through the whole social media stage, but fortunately my children are all grown up now, so it's not something that's going to affect me directly, but I do really feel for all those families out there that it's going to have an impact on in whatever form that takes.
Thanks so much, Sally.
That's okay. Thank you.
Sally Brindle is the Vice President of the Australian Isolated Children's Parents Association. And I am keen to hear your thoughts on the social media ban for younger teenagers. The text number today is 0448 922 604. Associate Professor Patrick Clark is a researcher in psychology at Curtin University. And he says for some teenagers, social media isn't just entertainment, it's a major source of social connection. So suddenly losing those connections can be pretty jarring. And for some vulnerable young people, that can lead to this trigger, or it could trigger significant distress or feelings of isolation. So I wonder if those feelings of isolation are more exaggerated for teenagers if they do come from remote areas in WA. The text number today is 0448 922 604. And on the text line, Dazza in Dowran says, where are these people during the consultation process? They all come out at the final minute to complain, but also, as she just said, they don't provide any support. Thanks, Dazza, for your text message. And also, someone else has said, this ban is the best thing that's ever happened to Australian farmers, because imagine the internet speed just increase overnight. I love it. Well, I mean, that's one way to look at it. Thanks so much for sending through your thoughts. You can do so too on 0448 922 604.
The WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Well, a Great Southern School farm is at risk of closing after 70 years teaching students about agriculture. Cogenup District High School has been advertising a farm manager position for the past 6 months, but it hasn't been able to fill the role. School farm teacher Mel Shepherd says having to shut the program down would be very upsetting for the community, but she's still hopeful that they're going to be able to find the right person.
From kindergarten all the way up to our year 10s, we have students visiting the farm each week to do different activities. And as they get towards high school, they then become my responsibility as a teacher, and we give them the knowledge bases to get them both ready for employment, but also delivering certificates in agriculture as well.
You're looking for a new farm manager. What does this role involve? What are the main sort of responsibilities?
So the main responsibilities for a farm manager is the management of our school farm, looking after the livestock, which predominantly are chickens and sheep, and managing the daily operations and enterprises on that farm, which also include during the holidays looking after the sheep and the chickens during weekends and those sorts of things, and also ensuring that the students have different activities to do whilst they're at the school farm.
What sort of qualities and skill set would you be looking for in this farm manager?
Patient would be definitely one of the key aspects of their role, because you come across all sorts of different children of different abilities, and have a good knowledge base of farming in the local and national sort of markets, as well as the enterprises that are, you know, in technologies and changes in technologies and implementation of reviewing and abiding by a budget, and also maintaining the registers and things like that for the education department.
And so I understand, Mel, you've been struggling to find someone to fill this position, and if you're not able to find someone, then the future of the school farm could be at risk. That clearly shows how big of a role this farm manager would play.
Yes, as it's such a broad role, in the fact that you have a componentry of teaching, you have a componentry of management, you have a componentry of having an IT basis for all the things that we need to implement, which are all trainable traits if we have the right people.
If you aren't able to find someone, obviously touch wood, that doesn't happen, but what will happen to the farm?
We've got a few options, but it'll be up to the education department and the Ag Trust as to what we do going forward.
You know, interest in agriculture in schools, I feel like it's growing. You know, we've had Boyotbrook in the southwest, they've reopened their school farm after 2 decades, and ag education's been offered more broadly with, I believe it's 2 new farming-related ATAR subjects that have been added to some secondary schools in WA. I feel like it's fair to say there's an appetite to have agriculture weaved more into our school curriculum. So are you hopeful that you will get there?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of our students go straight into either employment opportunities. They go away to ag schools, having that knowledge base in year 7, 8 and 9 to go into agricultural industries. And also, now that we have the certificate courses, they also can leave with something on their resume to say that we have this skill set, and for further education or for employment.
The school farm isn't just for the school. I know that there's lots of benefits that it brings to the community of Cogenup. How big of a blow would it be to the community and to the students, to your staff as well, if it was to close?
It would be very, very upsetting for our community. It has been part of our school for 70 years, and it was originally gifted as a piece of land to our school. Over those years, each student that you meet in and out of school, they all say they love the school farm. That is their favourite subject. They got so much from it. As far as general community goes, I feel that the labour employers and farms get from our students wouldn't be there, because they know, well, these students don't have those basic skills in order for me to employ them on my farm.
If anyone is listening and is keen to have a crack at this farm manager position, how do they go about getting in touch?
So they can ring Cogenup District High School, and their calls will be very welcome. And this isn't a teaching role. You are assisting a teacher. So it is a farm management role. Get in touch and we can definitely give you some more information about that role.
Cogenup District High School farm teacher Mel Shepherd speaking with Amelia Searson. And if that school farm manager position does sound up your alley, you can call the school on 9831 3300 for more details. So that number again, in case you missed it, 9831 3300. 12:21. US President Donald Trump has unveiled a $12 billion aid package for American farmers impacted by the fallout of his tariffs. Now, the aim of the package is to help farmers buy seeds, fertilizer, and other expenses for next year's growing season. Natasha Kemp is head of food, beverage, and agribusiness at ING Australia, which is a global banking company. And she thinks some Australian farmers will be impacted by this package, which will benefit US row crop farmers the most.
So major crops such as corn, soybean, wheat, cotton and rice, and they're getting the bulk of the support for about $11 billion. And then there's a little bit of support, that's $1 billion for specialty crops, fruit, nuts and vegetables. So they're basically direct cash transfers that are going into the accounts of the US farmers. And we understand that to be happening in February next year. And so what that is really doing is supporting those farmers. You know, potentially they've had high input costs, or they might have been seeing lower cost of their various commodity. And so that bridge payment is just to really bolster that segment of the economy.
So how have they been impacted by these tariffs and this trade war that the administration has been in?
So just say, you know, we all look at the trade war being US and China specific, but actually it's potentially lesser known retaliatory tariffs that actually might have been affecting them. So for example, the US export a lot of soybean into China. They've stopped doing that this year. And I think it wasn't until September this year, or actually maybe even October, that the first soybean exports into China happened. So as a result, you know, there's a lot of soybean in the market trying to find a home. And really that has an impact on, or could have an impact on, price. In the interesting sort of, what I'd say, a juxtaposition is that the price of soybeans actually went up this year because they were using it for alternative fuels and things like that. But the other sort of row crops like corn and wheat, the price of those commodities has fallen.
What does this mean for Australian farmers? Because Australia is sending a lot of red meat, in particular cattle and goat meat, into the US market. And I guess, you know, where they're not sending grains into the US market, they will be competing with the US into markets like China. So would this subsidy have a bit of a backlash on Australian farmers?
Some, but not all. So let's start with the broadacre crops like grains and oilseeds. So I think you're right in terms of it's likely to have downward pressure on price. But in addition to that, we're coming into another really large Australian crop. But globally, the supply of grain is high. So potentially you would see, or it would follow, that the price of those grains would fall. So you would argue, not great for an Australian farmer growing those crops. You know, that said, the crop is in plentiful supply, and, you know, I think, you know, you always have these issues with supply and demand. So I think over sort of long range, you think 2-3 year time, I think there might be a temporary price dip, but you would expect a recovery. For our beef farmers, I think for example, if you use that example, the cost of grain is going down. That actually potentially has a really good effect on beef producers. So you think a lot of our beef will eventually go into a feedlot, and you would be feeding those animals things like grain, soybean, so therefore the cost of that input would go down. And so potentially there is actually an opportunity for those processors or some of those farmers potentially to see better outcomes there. In addition, and this is kind of how I always think of food and agri, it's all like, you know, a global ecosystem. We still have a great opportunity here in Australia to support beef into the US. So they are still at a low point in their herd, and they will continue to rebuild their herd. And as a result, the Australian beef is required over in the US. So, you know, we don't really see this support or this one-off support for the US farmers necessarily impacting beef and livestock producers here in Australia in the short term. It potentially actually might benefit them by way of cheaper input prices in terms of the feed. In the long term, this to me looks to be a market disruption that isn't systemic. It's something that is happening to us. And I think over a period of time, things should revert back to how they were. In Australia, we're very lucky. We're not the cheapest in terms of ag exports, but we are the most trusted. We are a quality supplier. We're quite close to Asia. We've got all these things around quality and food safety acting in our interest, and we'll always be, you know, a reliable export partner. So I think that is always going to be, you know, that is actually the fundamental of Australian agriculture that is very exciting. And it's, you know, I think we will, in these times where there's a lot of volatility, if we stick to our knitting per se, I think we will come out a winner.
Natasha Kemp is Head of Food, Beverage and Agribusiness at ING Australia. And she was speaking to Megan Hughes about the news that US President Donald Trump has just unveiled a $12 billion aid package for American farmers impacted by the fallout of his tariffs. And in Australian dollars, that's an $18 billion package. 27 past 12. Well, Terry has called in from Gemalling about the social media ban on younger teenagers that we were talking about earlier in the program. Terry, what are your thoughts on it?
I just picked up my grandson from Perth, and he informed me, and he's 12 and some of his mates 13. So the whole class, 15 of them in his little class, have applied to go to be approved to use Snapchat and TikTok.
So
they've all been accepted.
So when you say, they've been approved to use it, who have they gone to? Who's approving them to use this?
He informed me that they, part of the criteria is to go on AI face scan. So all of his mates were recognised by AI to be between 17 and 18 years old. One was scanned to be 27 years old, and they're all 12 and 13 years old.
Wow. So it seems like there's quite a few ways around this ban that's coming into force tomorrow.
According to my grandson, yes. That's another, surely another embarrassment to the government.
Terry, thank you so much for your thoughts. Terry from Gemalling there, just calling in about the social media ban we were chatting about earlier in the program. 28 past 12. Now, you may have noticed in your weekly grocery shop that it's been a bit difficult to get your hands on those small and sweet bananas grown in Carnarvon. Well, there's a reason for that drop in supply. Carnarvon banana grower Chris Collins says he's harvesting half of his usual crop right now.
Look, it's basically just climatic conditions, Jess. So, you know, summer was hot towards the end of summer, which did do a little bit of damage, and growers lost fruit then. And then on the flip side, winter came along, and winter was particularly cold for Carnarvon. There was even a frost, not on my property, but on some properties along the Gascoyne River. There was, you know, they experienced a frost. Bananas, being a tropical fruit, do not like frost at all.
So there was the very hot March, which was then followed by the very cold winter. How much did those events knock your crop around?
Oh, look, they just definitely knocked the crop around. We're probably really harvesting half of what we should be at this time of the year. That being said, the patches are starting to look a lot better. They're growing and bunches are emerging. So, you know, it's definitely looking a lot better now.
So what were they looking like just after the heat wave when you walked around your farm? What did you see?
We seem to get these heat waves quite often. Basically, your outside fruit, which is sacrificial anyway because it's very windy here in Carnarvon, basically your outside fruit gets burnt and you lose that straight away. Some top hands of the bunch get burnt, so they're removed at harvest or in the packing shed. It wasn't as bad as what we have seen, but there was definitely, you know, a small amount of damage from that heat wave in summer. And then moving into winter is probably where most of the problems started relating to our production now, is when it gets really cold, the bunch can't emerge from the top of the tree because the tree's growing so slowly. We call it choking. What happens is the bunch gets caught inside the trunk of the tree, basically, and it's complete bunch loss. You lose that bunch and you cut the tree down. We've lost the bunches, which we, not all of them, we've lost a lot of bunches we should be harvesting sort of for December, probably November, December, and partly into January. We haven't lost them all, but we've lost a percentage of them.
So shoppers right now, I mean, I've been shopping and I haven't seen those sweeter bananas that I'm used to seeing. How long do you think shoppers will be noticing this shortage?
Look, this shortage is we're on our way out of it now. Historically, winter volumes are quite low. They've just continued now through these last couple of months. So, you know, volumes will slowly improve, and in another month or 6 weeks, I would expect us to be back to full production, because we're into the best time of the year for growing bananas in Carnarvon. It's not too hot and it's not too cold. So, you know, production will improve over the next, you know, month or so.
So how does this season compare with last year's and other recent seasons as well? You mentioned that heat waves are occurring quite often.
Yeah, they are, Jess, yeah. I mean, the last two summers we've had some hot spells. It's not unusual to have hot weather here in Carnarvon. If it's an extended period of hot weather, then that's when you get the damage. A day here and a day there of, you know, 45 is not a problem at all. It's just the prolonged heat waves, which last 4, 5, 7, 10 days.
Banana grower Chris Collins is from Mundilia Farm, which is a 40-hectare property in Carnarvon, and he was speaking with Jess Baker.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
27-1, and Jonathan Beale is in the studio with the headlines.
Thanks, Kate. The Reserve Bank of Australia has left interest rates on hold at 3.6%, as widely expected. The announcement comes after recent data showed headline inflation increased in October to 3.8% from 3.6% in September. A couple of months ago, many economists were predicting further cuts into next year. Many now say the bank will hold rates until early 2020. With an increasing probability of a rate increase thereafter. A 76-year-old woman accused of murdering her aged care roommate has been deemed unfit to stand trial. Suzanne Margaret Lupica faced the Perth Supreme Court today for an assessment of fitness hearing. The court heard Ms. Lupica, who has Alzheimer's, would be unable to give instructions to her lawyer, follow the course of a trial, give evidence, or properly defend her murder charge. And Federal MP Barnaby Joyce has conceded he's taking a large risk by leaving the Nationals to join One Nation. The long-time Nationals MP and former Deputy Prime Minister has defected to Pauline Hanson's party, saying he felt he'd been pushed out of the Nationals when made to sit on the back bench. He says his future is now in the hands of the people of New South Wales, where he'll seek a Senate seat. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much for going through that for me, Jonathan. It is 26-1, and at the start of the program we were chatting about the social media ban and how that's going to impact those under 16-year-olds who are just about to go on summer holidays or already started. On the text line, a couple of you wanting to have your say. Someone says, the ban on social media access for under 16s is practice for future control of free speech and dissenting opinions for the rest of us Australians. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. 0448 922 604 is the text line if you want to get involved in the conversation today. Angeline Prasad is with the Bureau of Meteorology. Angeline, I heard that it was at Karratha. It was getting to 44 degrees today. Is that right?
Hi there. Oh, I'll have to check the actual location. Sorry, don't have it right in front of me.
But what we know is it's very hot.
Yes. So there are temperatures through parts of the Pilbara that are reaching 45 degrees. So, yes, so it is quite hot out there at the moment. Yes.
So what's happening in the rest of the northern weather, for the weather?
So, as you mentioned, we do have a severe heatwave warning out at the moment that extends through the Kimberley, the Pilbara and the interior. Now, over the next couple of days, we'll see an increase in showers and thunderstorms. So that increase in cloud cover means that the temperatures will start to slowly come down. That increase in cloud cover, the showers and that little bit of precipitation in the landscape means it'll help cool the land a little bit. Not by much. So the daytime temperatures will ease off by a couple of degrees. So from 45, 44s, it'll come down to 41, 42. Now, overnight, last night, quite a few locations in the Pilbara did see temperatures, the overnight temperatures, not drop below 30. So it was very warm out there. So we'll see those overnight minimums drop a little bit as well. So get into the mid to high 20s instead of sitting in the high 20s to low 30s. So we will see a gradual easing in the temperatures over the next couple of days. And that's due to the increase in cloud cover, the increase in showers and thunders, particularly through inland parts of the Pilbara and the interior, and also through the southern parts of the Kimberley. Now, northern Kimberley has started to see sort of a return to more normal wet season showers and thunderstorms. So temperatures do have suddenly eased through the northern parts of the Kimberley, but we are seeing those very hot temperatures continue over southern parts of the Kimberley, especially through inland areas, but those are set to ease. So we will see the heatwave conditions ease across the north. Now temperatures through the Gascoyne will continue to bubble sort of around that 40 degrees. We're not going to see much respite there. So those very hot temperatures will continue. Not quite heatwave conditions there, but sort of getting more into the low intensity because the overnight temperatures aren't too bad through the Gascoyne. But yes, we'll see those very hot temperatures continue through the Gascoyne. As I mentioned, the temperatures will ease through the interior in the interior. Now, northern goldfields has been experiencing very hot temperatures as well, and that will slowly ease over the next couple of days as well. It's still going to be quite hot, but yeah, a general easing trend in the heat wave conditions.
Yes, those air cons are getting a real workout up there, I assume. What about in the southwest land division this afternoon?
Well, we've got a trough that's extending from the Gascoyne into the Goldfields, and it is generating isolated showers and thunderstorms. There's not much rainfall in it, but these thunderstorms are affecting the Esperance region. Tomorrow, the ridge does reassert itself. There's a ridge to the south of the state, and it brings in more easterly winds tomorrow. So the thunderstorms do contract further eastwards into the Eucla and the interior. So
don't get to see any thunderstorm activity for the Goldfields, the Esperance region, and the Southwest Land Division tomorrow. But we do start to see that heat starting to build up in the Southwest Land Division. So we'll see temperatures rise into the low to high 30s. Parts of the inland Central West starting to see temperatures nudging 40 degrees during the daytime. Now, this trough that I have mentioned, that extends through the Goldfields and the Gascoyne, does start to drift westwards over the next few days. So by the weekend, it actually sits near the west coast, and this is where it starts to deepen. So in combination with a building ridge to the south of us, it starts to direct quite hot, dry and gusty winds through much of the Southwest Land Division. So we'll get back into the typical summer pattern where we see a deepening west coast trough and a ridge to the south of us working in combination to provide elevated fire dangers. So we'll start to see extreme fire dangers in some of our districts, but also very hot temperatures. So temperatures, especially through northern and central parts of the Southwest Land Division, will start to near 40 degrees, so in the mid to high 30s, and some locations seeing temperatures reach 40 degrees. It is going to be fairly dry, but because we have got an unstable west coast trough that will be deepening, especially over the weekend, it is going to generate showers and thunderstorms, especially across the northern and western parts of the Southwest Land Division this weekend. These thunderstorms will be dry, so there's not going to be much rainfall. Now, a combination of all these factors, the elevated fire dangers, the very hot conditions, those windy, gusty conditions may lead to wildfires in the landscape. So this weekend is looking particularly bad when it comes to fire weather in terms of, you know, the potential for lightning ignition in the landscape.
Okay, it's not good to hear. But thank you so much, Angeline, for running through that detail with me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, we're going to get to the rainfall very, very shortly. But before we talk rain, Richard, let's talk rock and roll. Where were you last night?
Well, I was very lucky to be given access to a ticket to see the legendary AC/DC playing their second and last gig in Perth at Perth Stadium.
Do you know if it's for certain it's their last?
I reckon. They were doing well, but maybe it was the little exits off stage for the oxygen mask gave me the suggestion it might be their last one in Perth. But
who knows if it was an oxygen mask they were exiting for. You never know.
They did do very well. Wild show, loud, you know, great lighting and pyrotechnics on a pretty big scale. And Angus Young, the lead guitarist, he's doing well for 70, skipping around on stage and more nimble than me anyway.
They've come a long way from the back of a truck in Katanning, that's for sure.
On a downside, I was disappointed he didn't actually play his guitar on top of Perth Stadium like the Dockers guitarist. So he's still got a couple of stages to go. But overall, it was great. Very loud at the end. Also, small shame, they didn't play Who Made Who, and they didn't play Big Balls. Big Balls would be one of your favourites, surely.
I don't know what to say to that.
hey, as far as rainfall goes, not much around at all in the last 24 hours. So in the Kimberley, Derby recorded 35 and Marion down 6, and that's it. But just on a more serious note, after a deployment in North America, DFIS's largest air tanker is now back at its Busselton base in the southwest, just in time for the bushfire season. Mark Feast is the acting superintendent for DFIS in the southwest and says while the plane's based in Busselton, it can be quickly sent to other parts of Western Australia when needed.
Yes, it can. From wheels rolling on the tarmac and being airborne, the latch can lift off in 23 seconds and takes roughly two minutes to reach 3,000 feet.
Extraordinary. How does it reload?
It reloads by, we have volunteers and DBCA at the runway, and they actually reload it at their different runways. And we have a portable retardant kit that we can mobilise anywhere in the state.
So why Busselton? Why station there?
Well, because it's a strategic runway and it has a large capacity for the heavier aircraft, it's very central to the southwest. We can reach as far as out as Esperance and all the way up to Geraldton with the range of the aircraft. And it also, out in Busselton, it doesn't interfere with the metropolitan airports and the airspace up there.
What about if it's required on the east coast this summer? Would it make that journey?
Yes, it will. We've also got the National Fleet, which is available for large air tankers and Black Hawks, which is the National Fleet that have come over to WA previously, but we can also deploy it East Coast as well. Because of the grain harvest this year has been a bumper season, we've got two aircraft, water bombers, fixed-wing bombers over at Esperance, two based in Narrogin, and then another two in Geraldton. We've also got the capability later in the season to bring two more into Manjimup up in Albany once the grain harvest is done by mid-January. We've also got two Black Hawk helicopters that are situated up in Serpentine, Gerardale, and we have another two Black Hawks coming online in the 15th of December. We've also got our heli attacks out of Jandakot, and also we can pre-base them out anywhere in the state where the fire risk is.
Is it any clearer what we can expect the next few months, Mark?
Yes, because of the temperatures rising, and we've had that, as you mentioned previously, the winter rains, we've got a fuel load that has grown again since the harvest and slashing of the hay this year. So we're actually preparing to make sure that the hot, long, dry period, which will roll in maybe into March next year, so we're making sure that we have enough resources and fire protection on the ground. We've also added additional fire appliances into our bushfire brigades and into our career stations across the state as well.
Mark Feiss is DFES's Southwest Acting Superintendent, and he was talking to Stan Shaw on the Southwest Breakfast Show this morning. And that large air tanker can carry more than 15,000 litres of fire suppressant, and it only takes about 9 minutes to reload and can reach speeds of up to 545 kilometres per hour. So quite incredible, really. It is 1:45 here on the Country Hour, and there are still some serious fires burning in Tasmania and New South Wales today. One near Bogie in the central west region is at an emergency warning level, with homes and properties under threat. Meanwhile, an investigation is currently underway into the cause of a recent grass fire that started on one of Australia's largest solar farms in that area. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service is saying the blaze broke out inside the 425-megawatt solar farm on Saturday afternoon and burnt through almost 100 hectares. And as Emily Middleton discovered, some people are now worried about the fire risks associated with solar farms.
3 days on from the grass fire at the Wellington North solar farm, it's still unclear as to how the fire started, according to both the RFS and the solar farm's owner, Lightsource BP. But with temperatures above 40 degrees and an extreme heatwave warning in place at the time, a number of concerned locals began questioning the fire protocols in place for solar farms. Renee Harrison is local to the area and is involved with a group opposing the nearby Boree solar project.
From a concern point of view, the reliance on volunteer rural fire service personnel to fight fires on large-scale industrial complexes is my big concern. Whether or not RFS can actually attend a fire, are they equipped to do so? What the process is if the fire escapes and starts to burn solar panels, the arrays, any other infrastructure, you know, are the volunteer firefighters equipped enough to be able to do so? Are they allowed to do so? The other thing too is that, you know, RFS, it's pretty stretched at the moment. So these fires with industrial complexes add a layer of complexity to it all.
What should happen now? What do you want to see happen?
These energy proponents actually have more firefighting capability themselves on site, rather than shifting it to all to volunteers within the community. For me personally, I think that's just a cost-shifting exercise on the proponent's behalf. I'd just like to say in this interview too, asking questions about fire, you know, pointing out some, you know, concerns and so forth, isn't being anti-renewable, okay? It's common sense questions that should be asked, and communities need to know the answers. And one other thing I'd like to say, when you asked me about what else you'd like to see happen, I think, better fire mitigation strategies on proponent sites. If you look at Wellington, you know, there's a lot of fuel load around the facility, under the arrays. They've got fenced off vegetative screening, and that's meant to be maintained, but it's full of weeds and growth that sort of stands taller than I do. And some of that's not managed. So fire breaks, less than adequate fire breaks on the facility. So really, they need to be held responsible for their fire management strategies on their own sites.
Dr. Simon Wright is a senior research fellow in renewable energy at Charles Sturt University. He has undergone years of research into the differing systems in place to protect renewable energy projects from the elements. I asked him what some of the risks were with solar farms and heat waves.
Obviously, the incidence of fires during heat waves are increasing. The climate is warming. We know this from the science. And it's warming because we're burning fossil fuels and continuing to burn fossil fuels. So we are seeing average summer temperatures increasing, and some of the byproducts of that are that we are seeing an increased incidence and scale of bushfires, and that poses danger to residential communities as well as industrial communities.
It's not known at this stage what the cause of this bushfire at the Wellington North solar farm was, but I guess from your experience and your research, do you think mm-hmm. that solar panels on these solar farms have been built to sustain extreme weather like heat waves?
Most renewable energy developers, solar and wind, they obviously have an interest in protecting their assets. They don't want fires either. And so there is a fair amount that developers will do to mitigate against the dangers of fire. So, for example, you'll see a lot of vegetation control around these assets. More and more, developers will choose non-combustible materials, fire-resistant materials to minimise the risk. There's a strong focus on safety around the electrical components of any solar farm, for example. There's the standard lightning protection. There's constant detection and monitoring of what's going on. And then obviously, in a desire to protect both the land and the assets, should a fire arise, then there are systems installed, to such as sprinkler systems and misting systems, to respond if a fire should arise. There are extinguishers. All of the sort of standard risk management that one would anticipate at any industrial facility, you would anticipate in a solar farm. And certainly, you know, the research suggests that that solar farms pose no increased risk in the short to medium term as temperatures rise compared to any other industrial facility. My understanding of the bushfire at the weekend was it was started by a grass fire. That is a constant danger in these warm and windy conditions, and any industrial facility, any asset would potentially be exposed, and the solar farm in that regard is no different to any other industrial facility.
In a statement, the solar farm's owner, Lightsource BP, said damage was limited to the northeast corner of the site, and the impact on electricity output was unclear. They said that at this stage, no damage is expected to major equipment. The site is currently operating at around 90% capacity and is expected to be fully operational shortly. No further information is available on the impact of the fire at this time.
Emily Middleton ending that report. It is 7 away from 1. We're heading to Queensland now, where striking new purple-skinned pineapple varieties are being trialled. But you might have to wait about 10 years before you get to taste them. Gavin Skerr's family has just finished harvesting a small amount of the purple pineapples at their farm in southeast Queensland. And he says, so far the reaction from consumers has been overwhelming.
It's novel. You know, people just haven't seen purple pineapples. You know, natively, a lot of them are purple or red. They're in the bromeliad family, and there's a lot of bromeliads that actually have a red pineapple-shaped, albeit small, flower, etc. So within the species, it's actually quite common, but not so much in fruit that you can eat and enjoy. And a variety has been bred in Brazil. So Brazil's the native home of pineapples. Pineapples are native of South America, so grown in the Amazon. And the Brazilian industry have got a fairly extensive pineapple breeding program, have done for many years. And, they've bred these purple ones. There's a couple of varieties that we've trialed, and, they take 2 years to grow like normal pineapples, because they are normal pineapples, they're just different colour. But, we've harvested them in the last month or so and sent them off to get a bit of consumer feedback, and the colour is attractive, so they stand out, so people are intrigued. But one of them particularly has got a really nice flavour as well, so we'll get further feedback on them. But the plan at this stage is to grow a commercial block. This year we've only had around 1,000 of each pineapple, each variety. But if we do a commercial block, which is typically around 30,000 pineapples, to see how they go from a yield perspective. So, exciting.
And that second variety, it's been rejected?
yeah, we won't bother doing it again. It was just a lot more acidic. The industry has moved to the lower acid varieties because more consumers like them. But the other one didn't have the flavour profile we're chasing. We might put those plants back in again and do another 1,000 just to see if it's any different next time. But we won't be going to a whole block of that at this stage.
Pinata Farms Managing Director Gavin Skerr speaking with Jennifer Nichols about purple-skinned pineapples. And if you'd like to see what these pineapples look like, you can just search ABC Rural and pineapple and you'll find Jen's story. And you never know, maybe one day down the line it might become the Docker's new unofficial emblem, the purple pineapple. Watch this space.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. The RBA meets for the last time this year over the cash rate, a rate widely expected to remain on hold. Australia to host significant US military assets at bases after Osmin talks in Washington, D.C. What does the potential Netflix takeover of Warner Brothers mean for the movies you watch and stream? And meet the travelling music teacher who goes between regional schools, sharing her passion with students who'd otherwise miss out. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
4 minutes to one and The World Today coming up after the news at 1 o'clock. Well, there was a sheep sale at Mouchet today. Terry Birkin's been there all morning. Hello, Terry. Before we get into the prices for lambs and sheep, we didn't get a chance to chat with you yesterday about the cattle sale. And I hear numbers were down by about 1,000 on last week. All up, 1,929 were sold, including about 100 vealers. What were the prices like?
Numbers were back to just under 2,000 head, with another evenly mixed sale between pastoral and local cattle. Considering there were fewer feedlot and paddock buyers attending the sale this week than last week, the weaner market held up well, while yearling steers and heifers were back, with quality also a factor, easing 15 to 20 cents a kilo. The cow market also fell 15 to 20 cents, while heavy bulls lifted 5 to 10 cents. Local weaner steers were mostly presented in good condition and ranged from 336 to 510 cents, while weaner heifers were making 220 to 408 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers under 330 kg sold from 270 to 392 cents and heavy weights from 334 to 430 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers under 330 kg were selling from 286 to 350 cents and with more weight and frame sold from 250 to 392 cents a kilo. Pastoral steer calves started from 174 cents up to 380 cents with more frame and cover. The same for pastoral heifers, starting from 150 cents in plain scores up to 328 cents for bigger frames with good fat cover. Grown steers eased 15 to 20 cents, ranging from 308 cents to 360 cents, while grown heifers also eased to return 252 to 354 cents a kilo. Cows eased 10 to 15 cents in all weight ranges, with store cows making 160 to 280 cents, while medium weight cows returned 270 to 320 cents, and heavy cows sold to a top of 346 cents a kilo. Shipping bulls sold from 220 to 385 cents, while heavy bulls lifted 10 cents, selling from 250 to 340 cents a kilo. And onto the sheep sale, we saw numbers increase to over 16,000 today, with a full buying field in attendance. There were some very well-presented lambs showing good cover and weight against a much larger yarding of secondary lambs. Ewes also had good lines with weight, however, the majority of the yarding were boning and medium weights. The lamb market remained equal in most cases, while the mutton market eased overall by $6 to $8 a head. Store lambs ranged from $60 to $191, while air freight weights sold from $162 to $209 a head. Trade weight lambs were selling from $200 to $244, and heavy lambs returned $230 to $291 a head. Merino weather hoggets sold from $120 to $200, while Merino ewe hoggets were making $90 to $208, depending on condition. Crossbred hoggets returned $130 to $249, and young rams sold to a top of $230 a head. Boney mutton were making $90 to $182, while medium ewes returned $150 to $223, and heavy ewes sold to a top of $240 a head. Heavy weathers were firm, selling from $190 to $250, while most mature rams sold from $80 to $202, with several single crossbred rams selling up to $254 to graziers. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, Terry. It's coming up to the news at 1 o'clock, but before I let you go, Paddy and Gamaling's got in touch about the social media ban that's coming into effect tomorrow. He says there's not a self-respecting 12-year-old who would have got a phone that would not get around this ban. The world needs to call out big media to put a stop to this rot. Thank you, Paddy in Gamaling, and thank you to all of you for getting involved in the program. It is coming up to 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.